Michael Pollan didn't love to cook. That's right, the Michael Pollan, noted food journalist, booster of organic produce, hater of convenience foods, author of the best-selling In Defense of Food, just wasn't a great whiz in the kitchen, even though he forced himself to do it now and then. But in all of his meditations about what food says about us as a culture, Pollan realized he hadn't done nearly enough thinking about the act of turning food into food, the art and science of cooking.
It's an argument from pleasure, because what surprised me most is, approached in the right spirit, cooking is not drudgery. Cooking is magic. It's alchemy.
Pollan's new book, Cooked, is an exploration of several different elemental kinds of cooking.
I discovered that there are four central transformations that all cooking can be divided into. One is fire, the most elemental. The other is water, cooking in pots. Then you've got air, which is baking. In other ways, we aerate our food, very significant. And then there's earth, and earth is really fermentation, because it's cooking without the use of heat, strictly with microbes, many of which come from the earth. And I basically apprenticed myself to a master in each of those transformations.
And there were some interesting social aspects that you learned about each of these styles of cooking. I'm thinking about boiling water. We're talking about braising.
We're talking about, soups and stews and braises, which is probably my favorite. And this is the kind of the whole vocabulary of everyday home cooking. And that's where I really take up these questions of gender and time and why we've allowed this critical human activity to get outsourced to corporations. We kind of assume that, women went back to work and there was no longer time to make a family meal. But it isn't that simple, and it's a lot more interesting. The corporations were knocking on that door for almost 100 years. And after World War II, when they had invented all these technologies for processing food and making it shelf-stable and simulating real foods with fake foods, they really pushed. And they found their opportunity with the feminist revolution beginning in the 70s. There was this really uncomfortable conversation taking place at kitchen tables all across America. Men and women were trying to renegotiate the division of labor in the household. Mm. And then the food industry recognized they had an opportunity, and they said, "Don't worry about it. We've got you covered. We'll do the cooking." And KFC even took out a billboard with a big bucket of fried chicken and the slogan, "Women's Liberation."
Really?
So I really think we need to go back and finish that difficult conversation. And I've had it, with my wife over who does what in the house, and bring men back into the kitchen and children, which I think is really, really important.
You talk about the slowness. Braising, working with water, there's a
can't
lot of time.
Yeah, you can't rush it, I know. And so many recipes I read, say, you can make this in 20 minutes. And it's, it's complete crap. You can't make it in 20 minutes. And so, I spent a lot of time on this issue of time. And I came to see it as a kind of practice, as a real effort to slow ourselves down and not fight to rush things.
But so, I mean, I have to say, though, Michael, you hear this and you think, cooking is meditative, and I know that's a good thing, and I should be more present, but I have three kids and a full-time job, and I come home, and I have got to get food on the table, and I do not have the simple luxury of being in the moment.
Well, I have to ask a couple questions.
Okay.
One is, where's your husband? And are your kids old enough to help? And are they old enough to chop an onion? And I think that's very important. I think the most important thing we can teach our kids for their long-term health and happiness is how to cook. But I would also say that some of the foods that hold themselves out to you as supremely convenient, like those microwavable single portion entrees in the supermarket, I did an experiment with those. And we had a night, we had what we call microwave night, where we all got to buy one of those, fast food in a frozen bag things mm-hmm. that they now have in the supermarket. And guess what? It took 40 minutes to get that meal on the table because the microwave is individualistic. You can only microwave one person's entree at a time. And you're not sharing. And there's something magical that happens when people eat from the same pot. The family meal is really the nursery of democracy. It's where we learn to share. It's where we learn to argue without offending. It's just too critical to let go, as we've been so blithely doing.
You also have a nice story about a Sunday afternoon when you're cooking and your teenage son is not necessarily helping, but he's just with you.
There. Well, You know, we it's funny. He loved doing his homework at the island in the middle of the kitchen. And he would work while I was cooking, and he took in the smells, and he'd come over every now and then and taste what was in the pot and offer some unsolicited seasoning advice. And it was a great time. You know, the best time to connect with a teenager is when other things are going on, when you're not trying to have a face-to-face, when you're not making eye contact, basically. And so while he was doing homework and I was cooking, we had some of our sweetest times together. And then, of course, there was the meal.
I guess that's the answer to my next question is, how has this project changed you in real ways in your everyday life?
Yeah, I definitely spend more time cooking. I just kind of make time for it. In the same way I make time for exercise or, you know, doing my email, I make time to cook. But it's also given me this way to slow down a little bit and not fight with myself, not feel divided over time. And I am present in the kitchen right now. And you know, we live in a very mediated life right now. We spend our lives in front of screens, and cooking is one of the best antidotes. And it's a democratic pleasure. All of us can do it. This is a book about transformations, and I thought it was all about transformations of nature, but in the end, it became a transformation of me, too.
The new book is called Cooked. Michael Pollan joined us from our bureau in New York. Michael, thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you, Rachel.
Relationship drama. It can certainly lead to big ratings on television. But that was not the case last spring when NBC went through a very public divorce, one that ended up costing valuable viewers at a critical time for the network.
This is not easy to say, but today is going to be my last morning as a regular co-host of Today.
That's Ann Curry, who spent more than a decade as news anchor on the morning news show and then less than a year on the host couch before that moment.
And for all of you who saw me as a groundbreaker, I'm sorry I couldn't carry the ball over the finish line, but man, I did try.
And we're going to talk more about that moment and other moments on Morning News. Brian Stelter is a media reporter for the New York Times, and today he's out with a new book called Top of the Morning, Inside the Cutthroat World of Morning TV. And Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You kind of said that this was the beginning of the end for Today and its long run as being the highest rated morning television program. Why was this such a watershed moment?
Well, the show had this incredible streak for about 16 years. It had never happened before in television, and it probably never will again. The Today Show started beating Good Morning America in 1995 and then beat it every single week until 2012. And it started to lose to GMA at the same time it was thinking about removing Ann Curry. They may have thought that by removing her last year, they would get back to number one. But in fact, the opposite happened. They fell further into second place, and they haven't been able to get out of second place since.
In some ways, this doesn't feel all that new. I mean, the news business, morning news, has always been cutthroat. But it seems like, these news networks, it's very much a boys' club, the people who run them. And it's often women, and especially women on the air, who are scrutinized and often who lose their jobs much, much sooner than men.
It is surprising to what degree these shows are still produced mostly by men, even though they're made mostly for women. It's a strange situation that I think does contribute to some of the problems that happened at the Today Show last year. Some of this was just a PR mistake. They didn't come out and be accountable. They didn't come out and talk about why they made these decisions.
Do you feel like all of this might have been handled more respectfully if there had been more women in what is now very much a boys' club?
It's one of those hypotheticals that's impossible to answer, but there is a woman in charge of NBC News now for the first time pretty much ever in the history of the news division. And I have to say, the show has made a lot of smart steps since then. Maybe a coincidence, but I don't think it is.
I want to ask you about the book. You sometimes are narrating as a fly on the wall, but sometimes acknowledging your own role in events. I mean, like helping to break the story of Ann Curry being forced out. It's certainly not a first time that a reporter has written a book about what he or she covers. But when it's such a soap opera, I mean, how did you kind of find the balance in terms of being part of it, but not being too much a character in the whole drama?
It was awkward sometimes to feel that I was affecting the outcome in some way. Ann Curry later told her friends that she felt that me writing about the fact that she was in negotiations to leave robbed her of the ability to leave gracefully. But I'd like to think if I hadn't written a story in the New York Times about it, somebody else would have for one of my competitors. This was bound to leak. The network isn't able to maintain secrecy because people are concerned about the ratings.
A lot of the book is scathing about what happened at NBC with the Ann Curry dismissal. Do you worry that it's going to seem like you have an axe to grind when people start reading it?
My impression of the show is actually quite positive. It's one of the best brands in America. Even though it's struggled the past year or so, people want the Today Show to be great. They want it to be the best it can be, and I think people are now rooting for it.
And we should say, you grew up a big fan of morning television.
I did. I always watched the Today Show. My mom always watched Good Morning America, so it was this battle in the house, which I think is a lot of homes. People have really personal choices they make in the morning. In fact, Morning Edition is one of them. Today, GMA, Fox and Friends, Squawk Box, Morning Joe. We feel that we really know the people that join us in the morning for these shows, and that's why it's such an interesting and fraught time of day.
Brian Stelter, the world you write about, there's a lot of drama, and there is so much money at stake here. Why is there so much pressure on morning television to bring in the big bucks?
In this fragmenting media world, if you can have the most viewers, then you're going to be able to charge a premium. And that's what the Today Show and Good Morning America can do. If you can get about 100,000 more women, ages 25 to 54, to watch your program in the morning, that's worth about $10 million in advertising revenue.
Wow, that's staggering.
And if you lose 100,000, you're losing that much advertising revenue.
And I was struck that the advertising money coming in from these morning programs is crucial to driving, you know, entire news operations for networks like NBC and ABC.
I think this is something that most viewers and readers don't understand, which is that NBC Nightly News, ABC's World News, CBS's CBS Evening News, all these programs are in effect subsidized by the morning shows, because the morning shows really bring in the bulk of the revenue and help to provide crews out in the field covering news for the other programs.
You know, in this whole new environment with so many options, I think everyone, and NPR included, we kind of struggle to find the perfect balance. We had an executive producer here at Morning Edition who said we should strive for a balance between wonk and whimsy every morning. And I just wonder if, as this competition keeps heating up among news organizations, how does this evolve? How are we going to see programs like you're talking about change?
What we saw with Good Morning America the last 2 years is a pivot more toward entertainment, to the viral videos and the silly, cute animals. The Today Show has tried to resist going in that direction. I thought the Today Show last Friday, covering the manhunt in Boston, was at its best. It was showing off its A team and its A game. When we wake up with our cell phones in the morning and we see the headlines on our phone and we see the weather and we see the traffic, what's the point of morning television? Maybe it's going to be more about the fun and the friendliness of the cast, delivering you the news and delivering you entertainment in a way that makes you comfortable as you're getting dressed and getting ready for work.
Given this new crazy media environment, can you say with confidence that these shows will be around in 20 or 30 years?
I think for as long as we wake up in the morning, we will have morning television. Now, it may be morning video on our cell phones or on our Google glasses, but people like to wake up with someone or some group of people in the morning. They like to feel like they're joined by a larger family. There's a lot of companionship that comes from morning television, and that's why I think they'll be with us for a long time, even if they're being delivered to us in different ways.
All right, Brian Stelter is a media reporter for The New York Times. His new book is Top of the Morning. Brian, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Audie Cornish, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Imagine a world with machines that wash, press, and dress you before work, and vacations via hologram visits to exotic beaches. In his new book, The New Digital Age, Eric Schmidt, the executive chairman of Google, does just that. But this is no gee-whiz Jetsons fantasy. Schmidt partners up with Jared Cohen, a foreign policy counterterrorism expert whom Google poached from the State Department. Together, they forecast a raft of new innovations and corresponding threats that will arise for techno-revolutionaries, terrorists, and you. We began with an issue that Google has been repeatedly sued over, privacy, and how companies, governments, and private citizens navigate that dangerous road. Eric Schmidt explains their approach.
Unless people fight for privacy, they will lose it in countries which have no history of concern over privacy. In the Western world, the governments will ultimately figure out a balance between these two, the legitimate use of the police by the police of this kind of information and the incorrect use by others. But in many countries, there's no history of privacy at all. And so the government can go in and essentially create a police state without any protections for citizens, and no one will even notice. And once those systems are in place in those countries, it'll be difficult to reform them.
The other aspect of this, which we've come to appreciate even more because we've met a lot of parents around the world, whether you're in New York or Saudi Arabia or, you know, a part of Asia, educating the next generation as they're coming online young and fast is going to be important regardless of what kind of society it is. And
you're
regardless,
right, that people should actually have the privacy talk, the online privacy talk, maybe even before they have the sex talk.
We think they absolutely should. Because it's actually going to be relevant years before it's relevant to talk about the birds and the bees.
So the parent sits there and says, there's really no delete button for what my 10-year-old or 11-year-old is about to post, and I really don't want this following them for the next 50 years.
Now, Eric Schmidt, at one point in the book, you suggest that companies will need to invest more in legal departments because of all the lawsuits over privacy. And your company obviously has been criticized and sued over privacy concerns. At least six European governments right now are investigating Google's privacy policies. Is this the cost of doing business in the future for technological companies in the digital age?
I think it is. In Google's case, we do in fact have this information. It's important that we respect the way we collected it and the purpose we were collected it for. In fact, the lawsuits in Europe are about the fact that we, in fact, publish the fact that the ways in which we would use this information, and people want even more disclosure, and we're arguing over how much disclosure is necessary. We think we've done enough. But the fact of the matter is that Google has a huge responsibility to maintain your information, keep it under your control, and not misuse it, and we try very, very hard to achieve that.
You raise a lot of questions about what this privacy could mean for people's ability to protect their identity, to protect their reputation, to protect themselves against governments. But you don't offer a whole lot of solutions in terms of ways of doing this. Why is that?
Well, I think this is Jared. Part of the reason we wrote this book is because we have a fundamental belief that there's no country in the world that's worse off as a result of the internet's arrival. But with 5 billion new people coming online, while we believe that that is fundamentally true and going to be more true, we also have unprecedented visibility into the world's challenges. As 5 billion new people come online, we wanted to provide an honest account of both the good and the bad that awaits us. What we tried to do in the context of our book is describe a number of challenges on the horizon, very few of which we believe are intractable, unearth some of the debates and attributes of the challenges that await us, and foster a debate about this. We believe it's irresponsible to only paint an optimistic view of the future without talking about, for instance, the 57% of the world's population that lives under autocracy that is going to come online faster than any other demographic in the world.
And Eric Schmidt, for you, the same question. I have to ask, as someone who's the head of a company that for a long time, it was the kind of do no evil attitude. But is this book recognizing that there aren't going to be positive actors always?
I'm quite convinced that the Western world can resolve this tension between privacy and security well. I'm not as convinced that the countries that are new, that are run by autocrats, will get this right. And you can imagine, for example, that the Chinese censorship technology could easily be exported by China into other countries in return for minerals, which we talk about in the book. So you can imagine that the world will not be the same as what we expect here in the United States or in Europe.
Now, you talked about this no delete button. And in the book, you write about this idea of data permanence, that everything we do online will kind of, it never really gets deleted. And after a while, you have this enormous online kind of dossier that's sitting there and is potentially vulnerable. Now, doesn't this kind of fly in the face of what has been a longtime argument from technology companies that people can opt out if they have privacy concerns, that there's a way to kind of get out of this if you don't want to be a part of it?
This is Eric. We were making the point about society as an overall point. Companies, of course, do opt-ins and other kinds of things. But from birth till your death now going forward, you're online profile will be shaped more and more by online events, what people say about you, and it will be very difficult for you to completely control that. And so the reality is that a child growing up today will find more and more of the things said about them and the things they do accumulate over time. We'll all, of course, deal with that as a society, and there will be a change in social mores. But the fact of the matter is that our generation never had this problem. What we're seeing is in one generation, we're going from a very small number of people having access to information to almost everyone having access to the entire world's information. That will change almost everything.
You know, I think with all of these ideas, they sound very exciting, but the rest of the chapter will then paint such a bleak picture for how it can all go wrong, you know, that I'm not left feeling totally optimistic about what you're saying.
But by the way, that was we were not trying to leave you optimistic. We were trying to be honest with the opportunity and the challenges that we have ahead of us. Think of it as a roadmap.
But it's leading into a very dark wood there, Eric Schmidt. A titan of tech industry is saying there be wolves, you know, it's not very, you know, empowering for the average citizen who just wants to, like, you know, upload a couple photos of their family picnic.
Well, we believe that these problems can be solved. And one of the great things about our society is that you can write these predictions out and people will attack them and they will solve them. Jared?
Because of our increased visibility into the world's problems, and because the places where these problems are most serious are coming online, we wanted to talk about both the good and the ill that awaits us, because we can't sit back and pretend that only the optimistic things are relevant to us.
That's Jared Cohen, writer of The New Digital Age. We'll continue our conversation tomorrow when his co-author, Google chairman Eric Schmidt, tells us exactly what they were doing in North Korea.
The North Koreans, when you meet with them, are very opaque. They spend 5 to 10 minutes giving a speech which references the respected leader many, many times. We would then give our report, and they would write it all down, and then they would not comment on it. It was impossible for us to determine whether they're really going to act on our input or not, but we tried.
That's tomorrow on All Things Considered.
Some might find it tempting to say that the writer Nathaniel Rich predicted Hurricane Sandy. Well, he didn't, but he did write a novel about a disastrous hurricane ravaging New York before Sandy hit. Odds Against Tomorrow is the latest in literary genre that coalesces around the theme of climate change. It's come to be called Cli-Fi. Angela Evansy reports.
When Hurricane Sandy hit New York City last fall, the publisher Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, like most everything else, totally shut down.
It took them about a week to get the power back on.
Brian Giddis is a senior publicist at FSG. When he got back to his office, he began sorting through boxes of galleys, advanced copies of books, and one of them caught him off guard.
It has a picture of a flooded Manhattan on the cover. It's definitely sort of a Twilight Zone moment.
I had the very strange experience of editing the final proofs of my novel one night, going to sleep and waking up and essentially seeing it adapted on cable television the next morning.
Nathaniel Rich wrote Odds Against Tomorrow. The protagonist is a boy genius who spins out worst-case scenarios and sells his elaborate calculations to corporations. But not even he predicts that a hurricane will inundate New York. And, of course, Rich had no idea his novel would be so timely.
Yeah, it was eerie. But I think this is the time that we live in now. You know, we live in this time where our worst fears are being realized regularly.
Rich's novel, out this month, is the latest in what seems to be an emerging literary genre. Over the past decade, more and more writers have begun to set their novels and short stories in worlds not unlike our own, where the Earth systems are noticeably off-kilter.
I think we need a new type of novel to address the new type of reality, which is that we're headed towards something terrifying and large and transformative, and it's the novelist's job to try to understand what is that doing to us.
Of course, science fiction with an environmental bent has been around since the 1960s. Think The Drowned World by J.G. Ballard. But sci-fi usually takes place in a dystopian future. Cli-fi happens in a dystopian present. Judith Curry is professor and chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology. She began assembling a list of Cli-Fi stories a few months ago, and she says that when novelists tackle the issue in their writing, they reach people in a way that scientists can't.
You know, scientists and other people are trying to get their message across, you know, about various aspects of the climate change issue, and it seems like fiction is an untapped sort of way of doing this, you know, a way of smuggling some serious topics, you know, into the consciousness of the scientifically illiterate.
Curry says she first saw this renewed interest in climate change fiction with Michael Crichton's 2004 novel State of Fear about eco-terrorists. Then came such books as Solar by Ian McEwan and Flight Behavior by Barbara Kingsolver. When Kingsolver spoke with NPR in November, she said she wanted her writing to help start a conversation
between scientist and non-scientist, between rural and urban, between progressive and conservative, that when it comes to understanding the scientific truths about the world, there must be another way to bring information to people that's beyond simply condescending and saying, well, if only you had the facts, if only you knew what I did, then you would be a smart person. That gets you nowhere.
Writers can be sneaky in this way. Read all 300 pages of Odds Against Tomorrow, and you won't see the phrase climate change once. Nathaniel Rich says that was intentional.
I think the language around climate change is horribly bankrupt and, for the most part, are examples of bad writing, really, and cliché, first of all. Climate change, just as a phrase, is a cliché. Global warming is a cliché.
As far as Rich is concerned, climate change itself is a foregone conclusion. The story is in how we deal with it.
I don't think that the novelist necessarily has the responsibility to write about global warming or geopolitics, but I do feel that novels should write about what these things do to the human heart, you know, write about the modern condition, essentially.
Some writers are a little more explicit. Daniel Cram's 2012 novel, From Here, is about climate change activists. And Cram says he wanted it to be political.
Some people are just sort of using climate change as a kind of wider setting, whereas other people, I certainly in my novel, put it at the very heart of the novel.
Cram says climate fiction is still kind of a niche, but it will make its mark on the world of literature.
In fact, I think when we will be looking back at this 21st century, we won't, but if people will, then they will definitely see climate change as one of the absolute major themes in literature, if not the major theme in literature.
War and Peace and Climate Change. For NPR News, I'm Angela Evansy.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Over the last decade, two psychologists have revolutionized the scientific study of prejudice by developing ways to measure people's attitudes. Tony Greenwald at the University of Washington and Mazarin Banaji at Harvard have a new book out now. It's called Blind Spot. Banaji recently sat down with NPR science correspondent Shankar Vedantam to talk about one idea in the book. I'm going to talk to Shankar in a minute about the implications of that idea, but he's going to lay the groundwork for us first. Shankar?
Hi, Robert. You know, as I was reading the book, a story jumped out at me. It's a personal story. Mazarin Banaji, this is the psychologist from Harvard, she has a friend, and many years ago, both of them were young professors at Yale. Banaji told me that her friend had a passion.
She was a quilter, and you would often see her sitting in the back of a lecture, quilting away while she listened to a talk.
Now, the friend's name was Carla Kaplan, and the story begins with an accident.
Carla had a terrible accident. She was washing a big crystal bowl in her kitchen. It slipped, and it cut her hand quite severely.
The gash went from Kaplan's palm to her wrist. She raced over to Yale New Haven Hospital. Pretty much the first thing she told the ER doctor was that she was a quilter. She was worried about her hand. The doctor reassured her, started to stitch her up. He was doing a perfectly competent job. But at this moment, someone spotted Kaplan. It was a student of hers who was a volunteer at the hospital.
The student saw her, recognized her, and said, "Professor Kaplan, what are you doing here?"
The ER doctor froze. He looked at Kaplan, and he asked, "You're a professor here at Yale?"
She said, "Suddenly they were calling in the best-known hand specialists in New England."
They brought in a whole team of doctors, operated for hours. They saved practically every last nerve.
Somehow, it must be that the doctor was not moved by that, that the doctor did not feel compelled by the quilter story in the same way as he was compelled by a two-word phrase, Yale professor.
Banaji told me the story has made her reconsider how she thinks about prejudice.
We really measure prejudice in the old-fashioned way by looking for acts of commission. What do I do? Do I go across town to burn down the church of somebody who is not from my denomination? That I can recognize as prejudice.
Banaji told me she started to ask herself whether favoritism is the way prejudice really works in the United States today.
I think that kind of act of helping towards people with whom we have some shared group identity is really the modern way in which discrimination likely happens.
You know, Robert, most of us don't do bad stuff to people who are different from us, but lots of us give special treatment to people who belong to our communities or our religion or our race. You know, and for those people, we call in the hand specialist.
And is this, Shankar, the thesis of the book Blind Spot, that prejudice is actually a misguided altruism?
It's part of a broader thesis of the book, but I think the idea of the book really is that the conventional way we think about prejudice is to think about it as saying, I dislike somebody from this other group and I'm going to do something harmful to them. A lot of what Banaji and Greenwald have done over the last 10 or 20 years is turn that idea on its head and say, is it possible that people do biased things without actually realizing that they're biased, that the brain in some ways has a blind spot in just the same way that the eye has a blind spot, that it's unintentional, and yet it has pervasive and important consequences.
I want to ask you about that anecdote. Banerjee said two words made the difference, Yale professor. Each of those words is freighted differently. Yale is part of the community. Professor is prestige. You might treat a general in the army or a movie star better in the ER also for some reason. Which do they attach more importance to?
Well, I think Carla Kaplan believed that the fact that she was a faculty member at Yale is why she got the hand specialist and the team of doctors, and that saying that she was a quilter was why she didn't get the hand specialist in the first place.
Even though a quilter would rely on one's hands more directly than a professor would.
Exactly. I don't think we can actually disentangle these different effects. So it's entirely possible that if Barack Obama went to Yale New Haven Hospital, he would get the hand specialist, even though he's not a Yale professor. I don't think the point here is that only, you know, that in-groups are defined in very narrow ways where we say somebody has to be from our university. It's just the case that some people at Yale New Haven Hospital probably get better treatment than others.
We have a long tradition of immigrant groups looking out for their members. Societies that see to everything from helping the poor of one's own group to organizing burials and cemeteries. Is being part of a community like that and taking acts of commission for one's fellow members now being redefined as a form of prejudice?
So that's a really profound and important question, Robert, because I think you're exactly right, which is much of the time when we're helping other people, we're doing good things. And I don't think Banaji's point is that we should stop helping our friends or stop helping people from our groups. Her point is we only give that help much of the time to people who are part of our groups. And if we're going to try and overcome some of the enduring disparities we have in the United States, we have to try and direct some of that help to people whom we might not feel like helping, to people whom we might not feel like we have an immediate connection to.
Shankar, thank you very much.
Thanks, Robert.
That's NPR science correspondent Shankar Vedantam. You can follow him on Twitter at Hidden Brain. And while you're at it, you can follow this program at NPR ATC.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.